Next, John Lyle, also from the vet school, going to talk on another major issue, avian influenza. Thank you.
Right. Okay, so I'm talking today about a project that we've been involved with on avian influenza in chickens. So we address the problem by trying to produce transgenic chickens with resistance to the virus. So it's a sort of, not sure, kind of fits in with what you're talking about today. Need to work out how to use this. Oh yes, so that's the virus that we're trying to inhibit, segmented, so it's got 8 gene segments within it. I'm not gonna talk hugely about the biology of the virus today, so you don't need to worry too much about that. I thought I'd better pick up chickens, as that's the species that we're trying to adapt through genetic modification to become resistant to the virus. Obviously, anything you work on is the most important creature in the world, and in our case, we work on chickens. So in terms of global food security, chickens do play quite an important role in terms of meat. You can see the scale of them. There's 50-odd billion chickens in the world, of which they're divided between the high-intensity farms, about 38 billion in those, and about 12 billion backyard birds. So there's a significant proportion of chickens, and they play a very important role in local economies, the backyard scale. And when I say backyard scale, I don't mean 4 or 5 birds. There are sort of hundreds of birds, you know, in flocks of 100, 200, 300 birds being kept by many people in different parts of the world, and it's actually playing an important role in their own economy on the local scale. The global food production, so you've got poultry at the top there, that's actually the most eaten meat of the main farmed animals. The carbon footprint happens to be pretty low in chickens. It's they're bred quite quickly. They have a short lifespan, and then they're eaten, and so you don't have so many carbon emissions, so much carbon emissions from them. And calorie conversion, if you're talking about scarce resources, grain going into livestock, chickens again come out quite high in terms of the conversion efficiency. So move on from that. Why is avian influenza a problem? Because it causes production losses, which has implications for food security and economic losses, both at the local scale for the farmers themselves, but also for a slightly wider scale for countries involved in severe outbreaks. It can actually have a significant effect, you can measure it as a reduction in the GDP at the national scale occasionally. And of course, there's a public health risk to humans as well, because the avian influenza virus doesn't restrict itself to one host species. It can adapt and jump species, and then that's when you get pandemics. So one such pandemic happened in 1918, the Spanish flu. And you can see this life the average age of death here, this graph, and for the United States, 1918, you can see a real plunge, and that wasn't obviously due to First World War, happened with flu after the war, and you can't really see the effect of the war particularly at all. Again, World War II hardly affected the death rates, and the HIV era, again, hasn't really affected the age of death. So when you get an outbreak like the 1918 strain of flu, it had a mortality rate of about 2%, infected a huge number of people and caused a huge problem. The 2009 outbreak had a tiny death rate, was also global. We got away with that one. Had it been H5N1 that had acquired the ability to jump species with a 60% death rate, none of us would be here talking today. Well, we probably would. Some of us would be here talking very, very strongly about this sort of thing. but perhaps in different circumstances. So flu, natural host is the wild birds, aquatic birds. They tend not to jump from it to humans from those birds, but once they spread into farmed animals like chickens, like pigs, then you have contact with farmers, and that's where the animal-human interface is much more concentrated, and so there's a vastly increased risk of the virus adapting in those species and then jumping into humans. So if we can control the virus in avian, the virus in those farmed animals, we might sort of burn the bridge between those animals and ourselves. So in terms of doing that, So in terms of controlling avian influenza, the current methods are to prevent mixed livestock where there are issues with avian flu. So you don't want pigs, you don't want chickens brought together, because it's a great way for the virus to jump. You don't want wet markets where you bring in live birds, for instance, from different farms. One farm has infected birds, it crosses, and then they take the unsold birds back to their farms, and they've spread the disease in the market. Vaccination doesn't really work particularly well. The virus is a moving target, has a very high mutation rate, and so you have to have very closely matched vaccines to the particular strain of virus that you're trying to vaccinate against. There's loads of other strains out there, and the strain you're targeting the vaccine will become ineffective within about 2 years. With humans, we can keep up with that, but it's just not economic to change the vaccine every year or so in livestock. Biosecurity is hugely important, and is one of the ways of keeping the virus out of chickens in particular. It's incompatible, however, with free-range production. If you want your animal welfare, if you want your birds out in the open, they're going to be exposed to wild birds, and that's where the threat of the disease largely comes from. So, hence our project to breed in resistance through genetic modification. Genetic modification can be very precise, targeting a particular gene out of all the tens of thousands of genes in an animal, one gene if you like. You can also, with versatility, you can have different combinations. You can introduce a natural gene, you can introduce an artificial gene, so you have huge sort of versatility, I suppose is the word. And by introducing those changes into multiple founder lines, you can maintain different breeds and different the sort of biodiversity of the line. So this is the method we used to produce our chickens. We introduced made a viral vector containing our gene of interest, our inhibitor, injected it into the embryonic disc in newly laid eggs. That then goes on, the eggs are incubated, they hatch. You have chimeric birds first with some of the cells containing the transgene, and they then have to be crossed, and a second generation of birds produced. Some of those birds will be completely non-transgenic, and some will be completely transgenic, and so it's a sort of two-stage process. That's the same thing, just with a real egg, somebody injecting the virus, cultivating, and breeding on. So two types of inhibitor that we've used. One is an RNA decoy for the virus, which is a small non-coding RNA that simply binds to the polymerase of the virus and gets replicated by that. And so it acts as a sort of competitive inhibitor with the virus's own genome, gene segments. And the second one is to use the virus itself, the presence of the virus, to drive the expression of a gene. So we provide an RNA target for that polymerase, which is only present in infected cells, and the RNA contains a gene which has an antiviral effect. So the decoy, these are the eight viral gene segments. They all have a common end at either end. The little green segment is identical and shared across all eight segments. That's one of the segments. That's what one of the segments looks like in reality. The two ends come together to form a structure that's recognized by the polymerase, which copies and translates that RNA. And what we do is gut the center out of it and remove the coding sequence and just leave the end that can be recognized by the polymerase. So it acts as a sort of soak or sponge for the polymerase or a decoy. We made this, put it into chickens that I described before, and then we challenged those birds with H5N1, highly pathogenic avian influenza. And what we found, we set up an experiment where the yellow boxes at the top are cages, four different cages, and we had non-transgenic birds that were deliberately infected with H5N1, and we had transgenic birds deliberately infected with H5N1. So those are the two on the right, two on the left, non-transgenic. And then we mixed those subsequently with fresh birds, and those are the blue boxes. And each of the lines going across is a chicken. Okay. If there's a black box at the end of the green, that's bad news. That's when the chicken died because of the virus. So what we found is interesting, I think, that if you look across the yellow boxes, all the deliberately infected chickens died, pretty much. Slightly more in the non-transgenics than the transgenics, but there was death. But if you look down at the blue boxes, what we're finding is that the birds co-housed on the right with the transgenic birds, whether they're transgenic or not, don't die. So there's almost complete survival. One bird that died. These are sampled birds that weren't necessarily sick, so you can sort of ignore those in a sense. But these birds are pretty well all surviving. These birds are pretty well all dying. So we weren't able to protect the birds if we challenged them, if they were transgenic, but there was a defect in transmission from them. So transgenic bird doesn't pass on the virus to other birds, whether they're transgenic or not. So by blocking that, you could expect some sort of protection, I think, at the level of the flock, but not necessarily at the level of the individual bird. We then looked at our other strategy, flu-driven inhibitors. In this case, we insert an RNA that represents a similar to a gene segment of the virus, but instead of having one of the viral genes in the middle, it has a gene of our choice. And in this case, we either put a green fluorescent protein into that segment or chicken interferon. This is just a demonstration that by infecting some cells at a low multiplicity of infection or a higher multiplicity of infection with avian influenza, it drives the expression of these green fluorescent protein in the cells, glow green, and that just shows that the system works and we were able to produce something that would then enable us to express something useful, i.e. The chicken interferon gene. So we took some non-transgenic birds, and we took three transgenic birds and made cell lines from eggs from each of those, tried to grow virus in those cell lines, and we found that there was quite high yields in the non-transgenic birds, quite variable, but fairly high yields of virus, and those yields were generally hammered in the transgenic cell lines. So it appears that the interferon is doing its job of actually damping down the infection. Similar setup to the other slide that I showed. Non-transgenic birds at the top and transgenic birds at the bottom. So essentially, the very top, this stock donor region. These are non-transgenic all the way through. So they're just to initiate an infection. So the more interesting parts are in this box and this box. And you can see that the transgenic birds, a number of them survive right out. Some of them succumb, a number of them survive right out. And then when they are co-housed with a second batch of birds, the transmission chain is almost lost, and most of them survive to the end. Whereas at the top, they're dying and transmitting very effectively. So it's a similar but slightly different story with the interferon compared to the decoy. So what we want to do is basically combine the two. So we'll just conventionally crossbreed these two lines. And what we're hoping then is to have something that both blocks transmission of the virus as well as protects the initial bird from challenge. So we think we've demonstrated that the technology has legs, can work, but obviously the big question is whether anybody wants them. Okay.
Thanks, John. Martin.
Thanks very much, John. Martin Jones, archaeology. John, people have been farming chickens for 5,500 years at
right.
least. Is there much evidence before 1918, in say historical sources or whatever, that there may have been earlier epidemics, pandemics, or is it a novel 20th century phenomenon?
No, it seems that pandemics go back. Before 1918, there have been outbreaks of pandemics fairly regularly. I think that it doesn't always come through chickens. In fact, quite often it comes through pigs or other mechanisms. And the greater scale of production leads to greater risk. And in the 20th century, we saw three or four pandemics, whether you count the Russian lab release as a genuine sort of event, I don't know, and we've already seen one pandemic this century, so I think you can probably say that it's speeding up, yeah. But it has the risk has always been there, yeah. And all bird flu is essentially an aquatic bird disease. That's the natural reservoir. So we're a freak. Outlier for the virus, but flu has been goes right back. Really. I couldn't say exactly.
Thanks, John. Brian, and then I'll come to the front.
Brian, in addition to the question whether people will accept GM, there is the other issue of what level of vaccination efficacy do you think it would be necessary to achieve to be commercially realistic? Is it achievable?
I'm not a fan of vaccination. Vaccination, if it is poorly matched, is probably worse than no vaccination at all, because you are driving subclinical disease within flocks of chickens, and the virus is able to propagate against a slightly mismatched selective pressure. So all you're doing is driving the evolution of the virus. And what you don't want to do with avian influenza is to drive the evolution of the virus, because that's when you're more likely to get something that becomes more highly pathogenic or cross species. So I think that it hides the disease if it's not well matched. If you have a perfectly matched vaccine within the first year, it can have a very good effect, but it very quickly becomes a liability, not just something that doesn't work.
But you're hoping with transgenesis that you could get 100%?
Yeah. Well, the hope with this is that we're coming at it from a completely different angle. So that by introducing, say, the decoy, you could have good, what I call, effective and well thought through GM, or you could have appallingly thought through GM, which we've also tried. The way we do it is to introduce, is to provide the promoter, essentially, for the virus on a segment. And that promoter is shared across all eight segments of the virus. So if the virus evolves its polymerase not to recognize our decoy, it's dead because it can't recognize any of the eight segments. So we've got a, I'm not saying the virus couldn't escape, but we've set it a pretty tough challenge, which vaccines don't.
Don't come back again just now, Brian, but I'm sure the conversation will continue. Final quick question and quick answer. This is important.
I'm Joanna. I've just finished my undergrad in plant sciences and I'm now helping out with this.
Okay.
With all the major issues with GM in crops, do you think there's any chance this will ever get past the ethics committees? Because this seems almost more major.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the current climate is shifting, but hasn't shifted. So there's a salmon called the Aqua Bounty, I think, is salmon that has much higher growth rate, and that company is pushing that, and they've been pushing it for 20 years, and they've gone through all the hurdles. And then people throw a few more hurdles in front of them. So they're at the point where President Obama was due to give permission, and then he kind of went, we'll just put this on the back burner. So I don't think people are ready for it yet, but I do think that it's shifting. Yeah, and the experience of plants has been that we haven't had huge catastrophes that were predicted perhaps 20 years ago. That hasn't panned out. Or at least in my opinion, it hasn't. I think that must be some sort of reassurance.
And on that upbeat note, thank you once again. And now we have John Carr, who will...